Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, we kind of started with the idea of really wanting to grow for ourselves and just enjoy it so much, and started growing more and more.
And here you are.
And here I am.
That's Marcia Veldman of Meadowlark Farms. We speak with her about the gigantic sweet potatoes she's selling at the Bloomington Winter Market. Then it's into the kitchen to cook with yams and sweet potatoes. Before that, Jessica Najunas takes a closer look at what the labels on our food are actually telling us. And Gretchen Frazee visits the Green Acres Neighborhood Garden, where neighbors and students share work and food. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. But first, we get the scoop on the happenings in the world of food with Mia Partlow. Hi again.
Hi, Annie. Good to be here. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation wants to feed the world and thinks GMOs are the way to do it. In his annual letter released in January, Bill Gates outlined the foundation's goals for the coming year. The promise of the world's agricultural future, Gates says, can be modeled on the past, the Green Revolution of the 1960s and 70s, wherein engineered crops for wheat, corn, and rice helped farmers in poor nations vastly improve their yields. He also stressed the importance of developing crop strains that can withstand common blights, like wheat resistant to stem rust fungus in the Horn of Africa, and rice that can withstand increased flooding caused by global warming in Bangladesh and India. However, critics are voicing skepticism about the motives behind the announcement. In 2010, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation bought 500,000 shares of Monsanto, a leading producer of GMOs, worth a total of $23 billion. And in 2011, the foundation donated $20 million to the development of golden rice, a genetically modified rice strain high in beta-carotene. Monsanto also happens to be a major patent holder for the technology required to produce golden rice. Dr. Vandana Shiva, environmental activist, has campaigned actively against the use of golden rice and other GMOs to alleviate hunger in the third world. She claims the benefits of the GMOs would be outweighed by the risks associated with monocrop farming. The farmers would also have to place themselves at the mercy of the genetically modified seeds patent holders. Critics and supporters can agree on one thing: the need is real. According to a recent report by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, international food prices have risen for the second time in 2 months. As a result, several countries, including Niger, Chad, Mauritania, Mali, and Burkina Faso, are experiencing increased malnutrition and food insecurity. The culprit of the price hike, according to the FAO, bad weather. What do you think about GMOs and the fight to end food insecurity? Join the conversation on our website, eartheats.org.
We're sharing even more food stories throughout the day on our social media platforms. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
A definitive answer on food industry claims like natural or fresh might mean poring over pages of advice from government agencies or checking out consumer advocate websites. Of course, you might also start with the labels. But as Harvest Public Media's Jessica Najunas reports from Columbia, Missouri, the ingredients, or additives, sometimes can be difficult to interpret.
Pick up a box of your favorite packaged food. Now read the ingredient list. Think about how many of those recipe elements you can identify as good for you. Those puzzling words may be what are called food additives. Some have a helpful purpose. Anti-caking agents assist powdery substances from turning into a giant lump. Acids help food stay fresher longer. And because they're in so much of our food today, they are tough to avoid.
The ingredients are water, organic whole wheat flour, organic unbleached wheat flour, and sea salt.
That's Jill Lucht reading the back of a local company's sourdough wheat bread package. She knows a lot about food. At the University of Missouri's Agriculture Department, she helps beginning farmers get on their feet. And in her spare time, she volunteers at a local goat farm.
I feel pretty good about eating this.
Most of the food in her big black refrigerator contains snacks near to their original form, but there are a few things, Lucht says, that she hasn't considered until this moment. like her whole grain tortillas.
Vegetable shortening, which is palm oil with monoglycerides. That's kind of disturbing.
This palm oil keeps the product shelf stable for longer than, say, vegetable oil. It's generally recognized as safe by the Food and Drug Administration, but that doesn't mean it's good for you. In 2009, the U.S. Department of Agriculture researched palm oil and found it was not a healthy substitute for much maligned trans fats.
The multigrain blend has three lines of text, but it's all, you know, actual real food. So we get to the end where we get to the sodium, aluminum, phosphate, fumaric acid, mono and diglycerides, that part, the dough conditioner. So I might give these up. It's scary because I don't know what they are.
A University of Michigan study found that scary food names means a perceived high risk. They asked people to rate safety for fake additives with names that were both easy and confusing. On average, it was the tricky food additive name that had people fearing for their health. Though recently, some very simple-sounding additives have caused real trouble.
One of the categories of food additives that's long been of concern is food dyes, red 40, yellow 5. You'll find on thousands of packaged foods in grocery stores.
Michael Jacobson is the executive director of Consumer Health Advocacy Group Center for Science in the Public Interest. You might know him from the phrases he's helped coin over the years, like the pervasive junk food.
There have been questions about the dye's safety. There's been the most publicity attention to the notion that food dyes may affect children's behavior.
That attention swelled with a food industry cliffhanger last March when Jacobson's team petitioned the FDA to consider a rule that would ban synthetic food dyes.
The Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, acknowledged that food dyes affect the behavior of a subgroup of kids. Kids who have hyperactivity, food dyes can trigger that behavior.
So the FDA gathered experts to evaluate if food dyes would do the same thing to all kids. They found there wasn't enough evidence to support this idea, and that's where the issue has stayed frozen in time. In other countries, there's the opposite. The UK and Europe banned synthetic food dyes over 3 years ago, using some of the same evidence the Center for Science and the Public Interest brought to the FDA.
In the United States, we want to provide consumers with the information they need to make decisions about their lives.
Doug Karras is with the FDA.
If you want to avoid color additives, they are listed in the ingredients on the label. It's just a matter of seeing if there's color additives, and then you would know that you want to avoid that.
Putting responsibility into the consumer's hands. That is, if you have the know-how and the time to translate, there are tools around today that can help. If you're looking for an independent source, the Center for Science and the Public Interest has Chemical Cuisine, a smartphone app with safety ratings. If it's official word from the government you're after, then settle in for the long haul. The FDA still has to collect more research on dyes like red 40 and yellow 5 before the agency can give a possible green light to food dye warnings. Jessica Najunas, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. We're talking yams and sweet potatoes today, so first things first, let's pick some up from the farmer's market. I stopped by one of the busiest tables. Well, first I waited in line.
Good morning, Marcia.
Hey, how are you?
I've got some of the usual.
Yeah, two
one
of each.
One of each.
All right. Okay. 17 back. Thanks.
Thank
Enjoy
you.
It.
Do you know nearly everybody who stops by your table?
I know a lot of the folks who come through the winter market. Yeah, we've got a really dedicated group. But this year's been great. We're seeing a lot of new faces, so that's nice.
Thank you. Would you like a bag?
That's Marcia Veldman of Meadowlark Farms. She's selling gigantic sweet potatoes, herbs, and greens like Swiss chard and mustard greens.
Yesterday was kind of an interesting day harvesting because it was so cold out. Rinsing the grains in the greenhouse, my fingers were nearly frozen.
And it's snowing now, and it'll probably be 50 tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've got a passive solar greenhouse.
Yes.
And so tell me how your food is grown.
Well, we have, in the greenhouse, we have raised beds. And so you have to, for growing for winter, you have to get started, and there's kind of a window of opportunity in the fall, because if you don't start soon enough and the light diminishes and it gets cold, stuff will just hang out small all winter long. So with the kale and the Swiss chard, usually mid-September, and then the lettuce and arugula and mustard greens about a few weeks later than that. This winter's been real mild, so stuff has grown better. It comes back after harvesting quicker. Good morning.
Good morning.
Those are some big sweet potatoes.
Yeah, I know. But they actually taste the same. You know, some produce, it makes a difference.
How do you get them so huge?
You know, sweet potatoes are a funny thing. They will vary within the same bed. So, you know, presumably they have about the same level of fertility. There you go. Thanks. So, yeah, presumably it's, you know, about the same level of fertility and growing conditions. And I'll lift one plant up and it'll have just like two whoppers of sweet potatoes on it. And then the next one has five skinny things on it. They're just don't know. But last year, one of the reasons I like growing a diversity of things is when the weather is so unpredictable. You just don't know what's going to happen. And for many things, last year was a tough year. It was so hot and so dry. But those are perfect growing conditions for sweet potatoes.
So let's talk about how long people can expect to be able to buy sweet potatoes and greens from you.
I'll have greens through the end of winter market season.
And you're still harvesting?
Yes. Weekly? Yeah, it varies. I told the market master this morning, I'm not sure if I'll be here next week or not. It just depends how sunny it is. It's looking like it's going to be a warm week. So if things grow back well enough, then I'll be here next week. But by then, we'll be headed towards mid-March, and then stuff just starts growing fast. It's amazing. You hit that mid-March, the equinox, and stuff really starts to take off. It's a big difference.
Hey there, how are you?
I am good. What's the difference?
That's mixed mustard greens down there. Hey, Joe.
Read more farmer profiles on our website, eartheats.org. One table over, I picked up some parsnips for this first recipe. We're not straying far from our primary ingredient today. In fact, we're using part of the sweet potato plant you may never have eaten before, the leaves. But as Chef Daniel Orr describes, the parsnips really are the star of this soup.
They're kind of like white carrots. They've got a really nice sweet flavor. Have you ever had a raw one?
I have. From you, last time we did parsnips.
It's good.
Yeah, really good. Real kind of perfumey, a little bit floral. What we're going to do is, of course, start with some garlic. So I'm just going to tap these cloves down so they're easy to peel. So we're going to start with the garlic, and I always like to start the garlic in a little bit of olive oil and let it get just a little bit brown, a little bit nutty. All right.
Parsnips are a root vegetable.
Right.
So about when are you picking these from your garden?
Well, parsnips are one of the great vegetables that you can leave in the ground most of the winter. And until you get a super, super hard freeze, you can just go out and dig them. You can do the same thing with horseradish root. Turnips can go out a little bit longer, but not as long as parsnips. Things like sweet potatoes, you need to dig those before the first frost. But the parsnips, you can just leave in the ground, and they have their own little refrigerator going. So we've got some garlic browning, I would say 3 cloves of garlic, and to that we're going to add 2 white onions, and these are diced in about 1/4-inch dice. We can increase the heat. We're going to add a little bit of shallot, that's about 2 shallots diced, and we're going to let the onions and shallots cook a little bit, and what that does is it allows them to release their natural sugars. Since we're doing a light soup, we're going to just let the sugars come out and do more of a sweating of the vegetables. But you always want to cook your onions in a little bit of oil before you add your other ingredients, because that brings the kind of the sulfur out of the onions and it'll make them sweeter and less pungent. So now we've got these coated and they're a little bit shiny, a little bit translucent. We're going to add the parsnips, and I have about 6 parsnips here. All right, and we're going to let those get coated. And I'm going to leave this more of a rustic soup. I'm not going to puree it today. We're going to leave it nice and chunky. I'm going to add about 3 cups of water to this. You could use also a light vegetable stock or a light chicken stock, but I think that to really taste the parsnips, the water is just perfect. All right, I'm going to hit this with a little bit of salt and pepper, and we'll just cover it and let it simmer.
That's it? That's it?
We'll come back and finish it with a little heavy cream. All right, and then you can use spinach to finish this off. I'm going to actually use sweet potato leaves. A lot of people didn't know that you can eat sweet potato leaves, but they are just like a really nice spinach.
Can I have a taste?
Yeah, let me give you a little taste, the raw ones. I pulled them off before the first frost, and then you can keep them for a couple weeks in the fridge.
They were mild. I'm surprised. They're really tasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much like a spinach, but you know how sometimes spinach leaves that kind of weird thing in your mouth where it kind of dries out around your teeth? These don't do that, so they're even better than spinach. We're going to just add these in, and they'll give us a nice kind of contrast of colors and textures. The parsnips, just kind of tearing it a little bit, and they'll just kind of melt down. And that's all there is to it. We're going to season it to taste with a little salt and pepper. Here you go, have a taste.
Don't mind if I do.
It's very hot.
Check out photos of the soup on our website and print off the recipe while you're there. It's at eartheats.org. Coming up, we go back to the kitchen to cook maybe the easiest recipe ever, a baked yam. But it's the toppings that make this dish. And what's the difference between yams and sweet potatoes anyway? Chef Orr gives us the lowdown. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, 2 blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square and online at goodsforcooks.com.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Cooperative living and eco-villages seem to be popping up around Bloomington. The city recently approved one group to build a village of 10 houses on the west side of Bloomington. But for the last story in a 3-part series on cooperative living, WFIU's Gretchen Frazee went to the other side of the city to visit the Green Acres Neighborhood Garden, where neighbors and students share work and food. Instead of building a new village, they're trying to re-envision an existing neighborhood.
In the summer, this small garden in Green Acres, just east of Indiana University, is full of tomatoes, sweet potatoes, peppers, basil, onions, radishes, corn, cabbage, strawberries. You get the picture. It's a lot of food.
Notice how the city is now saying, please use your leaves. Ann Kreil Camp owns the garden, but several people in the neighborhood, as well as students from IU's permaculture department, tend to it, and, in return, share the harvest. Kreil Camp envisioned several similar gardens popping up around the neighborhood and eventually forming the Green Acres Eco-Village.
What we're trying to do here is really build an eco-village from what's already here. In other words, called a retrofit eco-village, where you use existing structures, and you can have renters and people that own it.
In her vision, neighbors would help each other garden and share the fruits and vegetables of their labor with everyone involved. Basically, a large-scale version of what she's already doing.
Eventually, I'd like to see in 30 years the whole neighborhood is an eco-village, you know, with zoning laws having changed so that you can have small businesses inside it.
Kreil Camp is petitioning the Bloomington Zoning Commission to change its laws so she can operate her garden without being afraid of overstepping the law. The Bloomington Planning Department says it's taking all the zoning requests on a case-by-case basis. Jim Aulis, a student from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is staying in Bloomington for a few weeks as a part of his permaculture studies. He says Bloomington is ripe for this type of community living because it has a lot of land that can be used for small-scale gardening.
Communities like Bloomington have a much, much easier potential and much easier transition than places like Philadelphia, like in the city, because the land is wide open. You know, the land is readily available.
Kreil Camp says she hopes people like Aulis will take inspiration from her work, leave Bloomington, and begin similar projects throughout the U.S.
Because we are a university town, you have people constantly moving through. So the type of gardening you have to do is really educational to help people learn how to do it, and then they'll move and do it somewhere else.
Her dream, she says, would be to see her grandchildren living in a world that is sustainable and lives in sync with nature cycles. She says she thinks they will. For WFIU News, I'm Gretchen Frazee.
Read more from the reporting team in the WFIU newsroom at wfiu.org/news. Before we go back to the kitchen, let's go to the garden with Chef Orr. It's time to plant potatoes.
Right around St. Patrick's Day, I fill up my baskets. And these are, you could use any type of basket, whether it was plastic or terracotta or one of these old wooden orchard baskets, and fill it up with a nice composted material. And then you plant your potatoes in it. Now, the way that you you plant potatoes is you get potato seed potatoes, and you cut them into little pieces, and you always want to have each piece have a few of the eyes on it. And then you let those dry out for a day or two so they build kind of a little barrier, moisture barrier. And then you plant them kind of eyes up into your compost. The great thing about this is that they're so easy to harvest that it keeps a lot of the moles away from them because they're protected. And when you're ready to make that potato salad for 4th of July, they'll be ready. All you have to do is dump the basket out and you've got a bunch of potatoes.
Potatoes are healthy little suckers. When they're eaten with their skin, they have more fiber than oatmeal, and one medium potato contains 42 times the daily recommendation for vitamin C, all for under 200 calories.
They're just a remarkable vegetable. And if you're going to eat a potato, a sweet potato is just heads and shoulders above a regular white potato.
Christine Barber is the author of the cookbooks Indiana Cooks and Homegrown Indiana, and she's the food editor of Bloom magazine. And boy, does she have a lot to say about sweet potatoes.
They go well with curry. They go well with warm cinnamon kinds of flavors, ginger kinds of flavors. I really like to roast them and then mash them with some orange juice and a little bit of butter.
But she didn't always have this complex of a relationship with sweet potatoes. She was first introduced to them, like many of us are, at Thanksgiving dinner.
You know, everybody has a mom's sweet potato recipe, but my mom's is the best. It was sweet potatoes, boiled and peeled, and then bathed in a caramel of brown sugar with cinnamon and butter. They just, it wouldn't have been Thanksgiving without having those. They were always the signature dish for me, with especially because we always put a little bit of salt in it, and it got that salted caramel flavor that now is a big trendy thing. And at the time, it was just like, why are you salting dessert?
You can check out Christine Barber's caramelized sweet potato recipe on our website. I'm sure it will be just as tasty in March as it would be over a Thanksgiving meal. Write a comment to let us know what you think, eartheats.org. Sweet potatoes and yams have come to mean the same thing in the U.S., but the reality is that yams aren't even distantly related to sweet potatoes. They grow well in tropical climates, and they're much larger and generally considered to be much sweeter than sweet potatoes. Yams are starting to appear more and more at markets in the U.S., so keep your eye out for one and then make this tasty and very quick recipe.
We're going to talk yams today, and what usually people think of is yams or Thanksgiving yams, and those sweet potatoes, basically. But the true yam comes from Africa, and it's a much larger root with a white flesh and kind of a barky exterior. They are a powerhouse of nutrients, and they're one of the greatest things you can eat. Also, they have a lower glycemic index than, let's say, a regular potato, which is starchy, and the starch turns automatically to sugar. And this gives you a much longer-lasting power punch that you can get going all day. I'd love to eat these even for breakfast. You know, you could take it some different directions. You could, kind of go southwest with it and put a little salsa on top of it. You know, serve that with a salad, and you've got a great meal. So, you know, I usually give these over to one of my chefs. It's Chef Mike, and he's one of the hardest working guys in the business. We don't use them all that often, but for at home, it's great because it's so quick. So here's Chef Mike. He's very reliable, and you don't have to pay any health care for him. 5 minutes on there. This is a nice high-powered one. With the home microwave, it may take 7 minutes. And what will come out is a nice, soft sweet potato that you can use right away. Or you could bake them traditionally in an oven. And what's good about baking them in an oven is they do get a little crunchy on the outside, and that adds another texture. And you do want to eat the skin, all right, because the skin has a lot of good fiber in it, very, very healthy. And you can kind of smell, when you roast them, I mean, it does pick up a different aroma than you would get in a microwave. So what we're going to do is, this is nicely cooked, nice and crunchy, just kind of open it up. Then what I like to do is season it, just a little salt and pepper. Okay, you could use a little fresh garlic, you could use some garlic powder, lemon zest, whatever you like you could throw in there. Then I'm going to put a little goat cheese. This goat cheese is from Capriol Farms. Put some toasted walnuts on. And finally, I'm going to drizzle it just with a little bit of olive oil. Now, you could use any kind of nuts. You could use some toasted pumpkin seeds. You could use pine nuts, anything you want. You could throw a little rosemary in there. But basically, that makes a wonderful dish, very, very quick. And there's no reason why you can't get that your day's nutrients when cooking is this simple.
The goat cheese really does make this dish. Let us know how you like it by sending us an email to eartheats@gmail.com. Special thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Chef Daniel Orr, Christine Barber, Marcia Veldman, Mia Partlow, Gretchen Frazee, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods, with cafe seating on East 3rd Street, at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood, and on West 6th Street, two blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square and online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week, we finish up our series of farmer interviews at the Bloomington Winter Market with the folks from Schacht Farms. Be sure to come back for that. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.